Thank you for joining our podcast. We hope that this message will both teach and encourage you. Here's today's message.
All right, let's go ahead and have a word of prayer, and we'll get right into this. Lord, we just love you. As we come to this moment, Lord, we're just opening our heart, and we're realizing we're opening up the pages of the Word of God. You have seen fit to put this into print for it to survive thousands of years and be remarkably connected, though it was inspired to 40 different writers in basically three different languages. When it all comes together, it comes together because it's your word. So we open our heart to you. We ask that you'd help us, Spirit of God. Would you help us to trust the Word of God? Would you help us as we struggle with trying to honestly understand and apply that word? And we just thank you that word is like manna from heaven. It is sweet when we eat it, and it goes down into the depth of us, and it brings life. And so, Lord, we just ask that you would help us to open up and receive from you. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Yes. I already hit the deal. Let's record. So we're recording. And you can hear me. So it's coming over the deal. Okay. We finished out last week and we talked about the idea that God provided manna for 40 years. This is verse 35. Until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. How long or how long should it taken them to get from this point in Sinai into the Canaan land? 12 weeks. Wow. 12 days. If they went really slow, like this. So, I would argue that the provision of manna was to just get them into the land, right? While they were in the wilderness, God fed them bread from heaven. Yes. And what's the original intended plan? Not by the way of the sea and by the way of the Philistines, because then their hearts would faint because of war. But up the Transjordan Valley, and is a longer run, but they would come by the mountain of God, Mount Sinai, and then up and across and into the land, which would only take them just a few weeks. How long did it end up taking them?
40 years.
40 years. And 6 out of 7 days of the week, what did they get?
Manna.
Manna and quail. To support them, even though they had disobeyed. Now, if you were God, I'm curious, if you were God in this transaction, what would you have done? What would you not? Now, there's a difference between what would you like to believe you would have done and what you probably would have done. And I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, well, I'm not going to tell you my dark yuckies. I'll tell you in just a minute. But I want to hear some feedback. What would you have done if after you had taken them out of Egypt with 10 plagues showing them your supremacy, opened up the sea, took them across on a freeway, and then gave them good water to drink after it was bitter, making it sweet, and then putting them in an oasis with 70 palm trees and 12 wells, and now they're hungry and they're complaining. At this point in time, what would you do? Matt?
Well, as Jew, I would say, all right already, I've had enough news. And I would pick somebody else.
Okay.
But you're no longer my people. You're going to keep convincing, you're going to keep doing.
So you just let them kind of wander their way back to Egypt? Would you do that?
You're going to keep convincing and all that, so have fun. I'm going to go find somebody else.
If okay.
I'm willing to listen to them.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. Anybody else? A little bit different.
Let it find their own place.
Patty?
If I know everything I know now, I'd go light on them, because we seem to think we're loftier.
Okay. So we have a powerful gift of mercy in Patty. So how many of you want to be around Patty when the chips are down?
Yes.
Be around Patty. You're going to receive some mercy. Anybody else?
You're going to complain about what I give you? Go find your own.
Go find your own, which there is. So they're going to eat all their animals, worst case, and then start eating each other. Donner, part of your 3.6 million. What's that? Let the Amalekites have them, or Amalekites, Midianites, whatever. Some ites from around that area. Termites. I would say after all I've done for you, I would, and I had ultimate power. The way I think there would at least been a large portion of them that would have been left a charred remains in the desert, and then say to the rest of you, what do you think? Anybody ready to listen? Do I have your undivided attention? That doesn't happen, though, does it?
That would have been forcing them.
Isn't that? But that isn't that. That's not how God operates. Everybody say, Pastor's not God, and we're thankful to God that Pastor's not God. Okay. So just think about you enter into disobedience, and then God continues to sustain you. What does that tell us about God? His love is never ending. Grace. Well, is it grace or mercy?
Mercy.
Mercy. Okay. I gave her the answer subtly as I questioned her. Okay. Very often, mercy and grace are confused precepts in the mind of believers. Okay. They're not set real straight what they are. God is merciful, which means He withholds the judgment. Okay. That we justly deserve. And then to make the provision, though, is He continues to provide for you even though you don't merit it. So it's a mixture of mercy. You don't find one without the other. They work together. They're like cousins or twin sisters or something. And we tend to sometimes go, oh, mercy. And then we go, well, no, that was grace. Or that was grace. No, that was mercy. And so they're easy, like identical twins, they're easy to confuse. Yes, Matthew.
Even the authors of scriptures, I forget who said it, but mercy triumphs over judgment.
Over judgment. Exactly. I love mercy rather than sacrifice. Because sacrifice is to cover a fault or a sin, and He's looking for mercy. So,
but don't you think too that it's just following what we saw in Genesis? He picks a project, and you don't stay with it. It's going to be a process, and you're going to have all your edges cut off, but it's going to take a minute.
Yeah. Right. How long have they been in Egypt? 430 years to the day. Since they had entered the land. So there's something He's been working in them. And here's the other thing. Let's kind of review. What was the reason? Remember, God talks to Abraham and He says, Abraham, this is going to happen, but it's not going to happen in your generation. It's going to happen later. Your offspring are going to go here for a period of time. Why? Not simply the fullness of time, but they're not at the time of the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Okay? Yeah. So he says this to Abraham. The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. The iniquity In other words, these are bad dudes, but they're not completely and fully bad as they're going to be. And I'm working here. And what happens? How do people get badder and badder? How did Pharaoh get harder and harder? Anybody? How did Pharaoh get harder and harder? But did he start by hardening his heart? He started by showing him mercy, and then what did Pharaoh do? He would harden his own heart. And he did that several times. And as it got harder and harder, finally, Pharaoh's like, "Oh, I'm not so sure about this hardness." And God said, "Too late. Too late, Bubba." But how is Pharaoh set up? He's not set up by a strong, he's not slammed to the ground. There is relenting. There is release. There's a showing of mercy. And then he comes right back at it. And then there's a showing of mercy. He comes right back at it. Finally, he says, "That's it. No more mercy." What happens when there's no more mercy? What's next? When there's no mercy, what are you left with? Judgment. Okay. So the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So he says, "I'm going to send y'all out somewhere else for a time until this happens." How long did it take for the iniquity of the Amorites to come up to full? 430 years. So he works with Pharaoh for a period of time. He's working with the Amorites how long? 430 years.
Well, even longer than that, since he first said it to Abraham. Now he's got Yitzhak, he's got Hold.
Exactly. So it's more than 430 years. But now God is done dealing with the Amorites. By the way, hint, you never want to be in the position where God says he's done with you. Okay? Not a good idea. So, but it takes a lot for the Lord to be done with you. That we're talking apostasy. We're talking reprobate. We're talking pretty deep. Pretty deep. So for those people that wrestle with the idea that God's done with them, I would just say with assurance, probably not. No, you don't understand what I've done. Probably not. Probably not. You're not understanding something about the goodness and the mercy of God. Now, He does not allow people into His glory that are committed to their own way. So we're not going to soften the entrance to heaven, are we? But there's a whole lot of people that wrestle with condemnation and struggle with this, but it's not God. Who is it? It's the enemy. Oh, you've done it now. Every time I've heard the voice of condemnation, and how many of you know to hear that you have to mess up? Okay? Now, I know this is disillusioning you now, but when I mess up, not when I messed up when I was 9. Let's put that way back there so you don't. But when I mess up, there is a condemnation I have to parry. I have to deal with. Because the enemy always comes and he's the accuser of the what? The brethren. He's the accuser of the brethren. He comes and lodges a complaint against those who belong to the family of God. That's where he works condemnation. So how many of you are in the family of God? Okay. So if you're in the family of God, then you're going to be the target of condemnation.
Yes.
Because if you're anything like me, you're going to miss the mark.
Yes.
Another word for miss the mark is sin. You're going to fall short of the glory of God. Now that doesn't mean you're consigned, well, therefore I'm just going to go and sin big time. I mean, if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to do it top shelf. No. But the condemnation of the enemy says, see, you blew it. There's no hope for you. God needs people who always perform 100% right on. There's no place for you. And that's how condemnation works. And he brings that accusation against those who are serving the Lord and walking with the Lord. So, all that to say this, let's go on now into the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus. So the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin or Sinai or Shinai. This is the desert around this region. And in English, it's really tempting to say, oh, yes, the desert of Sin. Yes, they were in the desert of Sin. Well, that's not actually what Sinai means. It actually means the fire. Some believe it was because they had almond trees in the region, and when the leaves turned, it looked like flames of fire all over that region. Okay? Because what does Aaron get? He gets an almond branch from this region. When he sees the bush that it appears to be on fire, it's not uncommon in the desert for there to be lightning strikes and other things, and for a dry bush to catch fire. Okay? So the trick was, okay, this is not being consumed. Okay? I've seen these before, and they're a neat sight. There's a fire, and if you need to light something, here's your chance. But, okay, then it plays out, and it's done. There's not much grass, not much other things. And so it happens. It's like a flash in the pan, so to speak, and go, ooh, ah, okay, that's done. Wait a minute. This is burning, but it's not being consumed. This is not a normal fire. Right? It's either not a normal bush, or it's not a normal fire. And that's what catches Moses. Where does it catch his attention? Near this region. Because his father-in-law is a Midianite. He's close to this. He's in this area, this region around Sinai. So traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. How did they know it was time to move from place to place? Off we go. And the cloud is going to lead the way. They camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, haven't they asked for water before? You brought us to bitter water. Throw in wood. No, now it's sweet. Okay, never mind. Thank you, Moses. And then they come to the 70 palms and 12 wells. Hey, we got water here. This is great. Thank you for your fine leadership, Moses. You have brought us to where there's a well per tribe. This is wonderful. We've got plenty of water. They camped at Rephidim. Wait a minute, but whoa, 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 whoa. Why are we stopping and camping when there is no water supply here for the water people to drink? So they, who stopped them there? God did. God, you're not a very good tour guide. We haven't been following you for a very long time, but you have really brought us into some precarious situations here. And so Moses replied, why do you quarrel with me? Your quarrel is not with me. Who is it with? God. Moses is a convenient whipping boy, though, isn't he? He's the one you can see. But who are they all following, including Moses? They're following God. And God has stopped in Rephidim. And there's no water. But there's no water. What? What is this about? So they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses replied, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? Okay? The Lord's supposed to be putting you to the test. You're not supposed to be putting the Lord to the test. But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst? This is a horrible way to go, by the way. Die from thirst. Go into hallucinations, all kinds of stuff. It just gets really bizarre. Right? The stories I've heard of people that were dying of thirst. So, dehydration, what happens with dehydration?
Your skin just basically crumples up.
Okay, so it affects you physically that way. What does it do to your mind? What does it do to your brain? You start seeing things, talking funny, weird, strange things, you don't remember, you can pass out, right? Right? Water does a body good. And so Moses replied, but the people were thirsty. Right. Okay, there we go. So not only them, but their livestock, right? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." So Moses is always on the edge of extinction, isn't he? His leadership is feast and famine. One day he is the greatest leader ever. And the next day he is the loserest. He's the worst. He's terrible. He doesn't know how. Are you sure you came from this region and came to Egypt to get us? You can't even take us, knowing that there's 3.6 million of us, you can't take us to a place where you can't pick the spots on the trip to take care of these basic human needs. You're not a very good leader. And so the Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile." What's the Nile? River in Egypt. Wonderful water source. I don't know. Maybe he has one for Monday and one for Tuesday and one for Wednesday. And then he has the special occasion, smite the water staff. And so he says, take that staff in your hand, the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Isn't that the risk? Isn't that the risk? Isn't that certainly the risk, that they can make a correlation between complaining and getting what they want?
Sound like a bunch of 2-year-olds.
Are these people mature spiritually?
No.
No, they're babies. They may be adults, but when it comes to following God and knowing God, are they anything close to Abraham? Are they anything close to Isaac? Anything close to Jacob? And Jacob was a scoundrel now. No, they've been down there, and now Moses comes, and does Moses know the Lord or what? He's been 40 years in the wilderness already, having fled from Egypt. And so they are just now reconnecting with and seeing for the first time revelation of God's nature. Now, when a revelation happens, kind of describe for me, let's get some feedback here. What happens when God reveals himself? What ways does he kind of reveal himself to people? You can use this context or even another context in your life. What happens? What does a revelation typically look like? Rick? Now, he told Moses that. So when a revelation happens, how do people typically respond? Give me some of the responses to people give towards a revelation.
Disbelief.
Isn't that something that happens? Because this is an unbelievable incident.
Confusion.
Right?
What?
Confusion.
Come up with a scientific explanation.
Come up with a naturalistic explanation. Mm-hmm. Right. And we hope that people would come to a repentance and go, uh-oh, we haven't been lining up, right? So is a revelation enough? Does that seal the deal?
No.
We have to respond to the revelation with what?
Faith.
It always requires a response of faith. Did Jacob have a revelation of God in Canaan land before he made it to the land of the Aramaeans?
Yes.
What was the revelation he received? No, no. Before, as he was leaving town, he's going. He's in Luz, the town of Luz, which was later called
Bethel.
Right. And so, would you agree that that was a revelation? It came to him in what form?
Dream.
And in this dream, this revelation, what did he see? So there's a ladder. There's from heaven to earth. Angels going up and down. And who speaks to him from up there? God. So based on that revelation, what is he asked to believe? What conclusions does he reach? What does he now believe that he didn't believe before? He tells us, next couple verses. You remember?
Surely God was here and I didn't even...
He takes some oil and he dabs it on the rocks and he says, this is the gateway into heaven. This is a gateway. This is a portal. If angels are coming and going, this is an important place. There's something going on here. And I was totally unaware of it. So now he's at least aware. And he has connection with God and says, you'll know because you'll go and I'll bless you and then I'll bring you back. Right? So, is Jacob's life radically altered and his behavior radically altered from that revelation?
No.
He still lies and cheats. Now, you would think that a revelation like that would cure the lying and the cheating, wouldn't you? Information doesn't change behavior, but it's a revelation, isn't it? What does a person... There's another word that ends, and we like this because it ends T-I-O-N, not information, but integration. Because information's fine, it's revelatory. But you have to integrate it in order to learn. How does a teacher know her student has learned? When he can take that concept and integrate it into his life, and then you can go, oh, look there. Look at, he's doing this now. He's learning because he's integrating it. Because you can, here's something I had to deal with. And my teachers, one of their frustrations with me was that I had nearly photographic memory at the time. I lost it about college. Okay, and I've been... It comes and goes, okay? Let me just tell you, the Xerox machine sometimes is not plugged in. But because I had a memory, I could memorize information and regurgitate it on a test and get 100. But if you asked me certain questions that called for me to integrate the information, I couldn't do it. And so there were certain kinds of tests I liked and other kinds of tests I did not like. And so, true, false, multiple guess, I got you. Because you've given me enough hints in the question and the answers, I can deduce which one it is, and I got it. But give me an essay question and say, explain to me these five principles and how they played out within the Roman Empire. Then I'm going, okay, I can tell you the emperor's names, I can tell you when they ruled, I can tell you what the monetary value of the coin was and how it equivalent to today, but I couldn't tell you why those were five major things. Why? Because I memorized things and could see them and instantly recall them, I wouldn't take the time to integrate them and make the connections and really learn what I was reading. So that's my confession for today. I have more. Stick around. So the people of Israel are given information. They're confronted with new information, but they're not really good yet at integrating it. If this is so, then that.
Well, they're still too thinking that he's a locality.
And they've been raised thinking, well, these gods, they do local, regional things.
So they keep thinking, well, maybe we're outside now.
Yeah, because even though they sang the song, what information did Moses give them in the song? He leads them in an informational song, revelational song. Give praise to the Lord, for He has triumphed gloriously. The horse and the rider He has thrown into the sea. He is the Lord. He is our God. He is this great one. and He provides for us, and He defends us, and He heals us, and He... And they're sitting there going, huh? All of that? All of that. Now, we know He can defeat the Egyptian gods, but we crossed the border. So, maybe in this new land over here, we have to deal... Are you saying that this is the same God over here? On this side? Okay, we can buy that He was the God over there because He showed up in a pillar, but now He's over here. Does He have a right to be over here? Is He in charge over here? We've never been in this land before. Now, we kind of laugh at that, but here's another one of those confessions. See if you see what your response is to this and kind of where you stand. Have you ever struggled with the idea when you move somewhere or you go somewhere, a foreign country, another state, and that could be the same thing for us Texans. Foreign country, other state. I mean, we go to New Mexico, that's a foreign country. That when you get there, you have a sense of, Lord, are You here? Anybody ever struggle with that or think about that?
Yeah.
Am I the only insane one? Patty.
I went to Las Vegas.
Okay. When you went to Las Vegas, kind of what you're thinking when you go to Las Vegas?
I was like, I hope
you come back. Because no one from this place is going. And definitely not me. There is. There's some growing Assembly of God churches there. Oh, absolutely.
So we're still, like, I identify with him because I get that. There's still parts where I'm, like, trying to figure out how does that all...
Yes. So...
We don't understand the omnipresence.
Does the Lord know this about the Israelites? Yeah. And, you know, when I lived in Ohio, and then when I was about... We had great revivals in our church. It was amazing. Dale Everett was an evangelist there and others. We had just a host. We had healings, miraculous things. The church exploded. I mean, every Sunday it was about the power of God on display. I mean, I was so thankful I was raised in that environment. So timely. And then, Mom and Dad decided that the snowfall of 1977, the blizzard of 77... in northeastern Ohio was the last one. My dad was going to drive 25 miles one way to work in. And so they inquired where the most sun was, and they had two choices, Phoenix, Arizona, or Albuquerque, New Mexico. So he consulted the Farmer's Almanac and a couple weather guides. Then he consulted the head of the company or the HR head and said, I want to transfer. Well, where to? Look for me some spot in where the sun shines the most. And the least amount of snow in inches. He said, I got two openings. One is Phoenix, Arizona. The other one's Albuquerque, New Mexico. He said, okay, I'm going to, as soon as we can get out of the driveway, I'm going to take a week and I'm going to drive to Phoenix, Arizona. We have friends out there and we're going to stay out there with them and we're going to check out that city and then and that office. And then I'm going to come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, check that out. And then I'm going to drive back home. And you'll have my answer, which one I'm going to. He said, okay, fine. They went out, prayed for about a week, and said, we're moving to Albuquerque. So I was excited. This is new. We're going to be out amongst the cowboys and Indians and the Badlands and the Red Sand Hills, and this is going to be great. So we sold everything, packed up our clothes in boxes, and mailed it UPS to a cousin of my mom's that lived in Albuquerque, packed up a Buick station wagon, and a Datsun B210, loaded them except for the passenger space, sold everything else, and most of that was my dad's tools. How many of you know you can sell everything else, but you can't sell dad's tools? And we drove down on the axles, very little spring action, with two CB radios.
Oh, hi there.
And it was Bottle Cap and Dr. Pepper. Breaker 19, this is Bottle Cap. You got your ears on, Dr. Pepper? Yeah, where are you? Well, we're at mile marker such and such. You know, it's back and forth. We had fun with it. We had us a little convoy, and off we went from Ohio all the way to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Rain, storms, all kinds of stuff. We lived in a Motel 6 for a couple weeks. Then we moved to an apartment, then bought a house and so on, and we settled there. We found a church, an Assemblies of God church there, and they hadn't fell over a revival in years. And when I got to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and crossed the state line of New Mexico, I just wondered, God, are you here? I know you're in Salem, Ohio. I know that you move up and down the aisles of that church. And I know those people know you. But here I am amongst these yahoos that are closer to California than anything. And after church, they go to restaurants, and all the restaurants here have bars in them. Not bars over the windows. Alcohol-serving bars. All of them do. And it's like, oh, where I come from, you can't even be in a place that serves alcohol. If Jesus comes back, you're stuck. And so I'm sitting here in this culture shock going, is God here? Is God anywhere here? And then I had to discover, yes, He was. And then later I went, answered the call, went to ministry school, and drove into Texas and was like, God, are you here? Is the Lord here? And it seemed, it was so real to me, I told my dad in a phone call, I was very relieved. I said, Dad, I've been down here a week and God's here too. Now that may sound like it's just a joke, but I was as serious as a heart attack. I had no doubt He was in Ohio. I had to come to figure out how He was in Albuquerque, but I just wasn't sure about Waxahachie, Texas. Yes? Huh? Should have been a Baptist? Why? So, that's really where we live. Okay, in this circumstance and situation, I know God's there. But now we've just crossed the water, and now we're over here in this wilderness around this mountain. We've never been here before. This is nowhere close to... We came from Canaan, which is up there, for those that weren't directionally challenged. And the rest of them are saying, I know one thing for sure, this ain't Canaan. And Moses is showing them that God is God. He's with us. Okay? He's with us. So He says, I will stand there... I love that. I will stand there with you. Rather than God saying, okay, you go over there. He doesn't. He says, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out of her, the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now that's a very real struggle. Is the Lord among us or not? Is the Lord... Now let's personalize that. Amongst the group, you would say, is the Lord among us or not? Is the Lord with me or not? Well, what did He promise? Lo, I will be with you always, even to the very end of the eschaton, the end of the age. That's Matthew's gospel. That's the tail end of John. So, now, we've seen some of the video here. And this is so fascinating. This is just like gravity and intellect defying. Because up on a hill, there is a split rock. And then down the hill is erosion from rushing water at this spot. And it's like, you brought water up out of the ground through a split in the rock and then poured it down the hill in the middle of a desert. They knew about wells in the desert, but now they have a bubbling up spring on a hill in the desert. That's amazing. That's astounding. And if I were him, it would have been dirty water and tasted nasty. But it would have been sulfuric rotten egg. It won't hurt you, it just smells bad. We used to have a place called Lake Milton, and oh, you had to bring your water. Because all the public drinking fountains smelled as bad as the fish that were washing up on the beach. It was like, oh, I just can't get past this. And sometimes you would be so desperately thirsty that you go take a big cold gulp of that. But it was like the aftertaste was like, oh, this is just nasty. No, that's not what he does. He gives them good water, spring water in the desert. So does the Lord know how to take care of us or what? Us quarreling, squabbling, saying, oh, I don't know if you're here or not. So, now, you've just come through a test where the people have tested God. But they have also have a chance to integrate something. And what's the continual lesson? I will provide. Yahweh, Yireh, Jehovah, Jireh. I am the Lord shall provide. The Lord shall provide. So, originally where it came to, this promise came was to Abraham. Do you remember the context? They went to Mount Moriah to make a sacrifice. And who was going to be the sacrifice? Isaac. So they go up on Mount Moriah, and Abraham says, on the mountain of the Lord the Lord shall provide for himself a ram. And so that place is then called, they reference this as they call God by this name. Because remember what Abraham does. He builds altars and calls upon the name of the Lord. Now think about that. The altars he's built so far bear different names of the Lord. Is that fair? But he also knows this is the same God. He's living in a culture that builds a different altar and names it differently because it's a different God. They're regional, fallen beings, occultic figures, their demonic spirit and energy and power. But now he's so different. He builds altars and names them by the revelation of the Lord at that time. Now, these people have this in their background. How long has this idea of Jehovah Jireh been spoken to them? Over 500 years. 5 centuries. Wouldn't you say that's kind of like a tradition? This should be a tradition by now. Well, of course. If nothing else, we know him as Yahweh Yireh. We're out here in the desert. He'll provide water. He shall provide. How many of them got taught that?
A lot of generations, and did they get taught?
Did they get taught it? And if they knew about it, the next step is, did they believe it? Now, they knew it. If they knew it, did they integrate it? Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure they went to Easter egg hunts, but okay. Yeah. So now they're here in full love, living color. They're living it, right? And he says, okay, I'm wanting to reveal to you who I am. I'm the provider. They're always calling into question whether or not he's good and whether he's really the provider. They've heard it sung at the Dead Sea. They heard it taught, the tradition of Abraham, who worships at the altar of Jehovah Jireh, the Lord himself shall provide. He declares this, and here we are 500 plus years, maybe 600 years, and you go 40-year generation, 80-year generation, 100-year generation, so between 6 and 13 generations, and they're sitting there going, who? Yeah, it breaks down. And what have they been living in? Egypt doesn't have this concept. This is totally foreign. Wait, one God, all things? What? How can this be? So,
Israel is a slave in Egypt.
And they're a slave in Egypt. And they're in households of people who are worshipers of these different regional gods and the God of the river and the god of the valley and the god of the vine and the god of this and the god of that. And so this is what their world is. And so when you have the water supply being in question, what is it? A test. And why is the test there? For them to see what's in them, what's not integrated, what is integrated. Is there much integrated? No. And then God revealing Himself in a very tangible way, okay, I am your provision. Here you go. Out here where it's impossible, who's going to expect a rock to split open and have enough water for 3.6 million people to drink plus their cattle? How are you going to pour out 55 tank cars of water per day and take care of these people? Out in the desert, there's not enough rainfall. There's not enough plastic jugs to catch the rain when it does fall. And so this is it. Now, what is the Bible asking us to believe? That God made supernatural, miraculous provision for these people. And it was stupendous in scope. Absolutely stupendous in scope. So how many of you know the test isn't over? Okay. What's that? Oh, absolutely. It encourages it, doesn't it? It strengthens it. It stirs it up. Okay. So, end of the test, right? Okay, let's go into the promised land now, guys. Nope. Okay, so here's what let's do. Let's take a break right here, and then we'll go on with verse number 8. I think we can get through the 17th chapter of... Is it a short one? See, hope is already in your heart. So let's take about a 5-minute break. All right, we'll jump back in. And so when these people are walking with the Lord, He's putting them through tests. They're responding, putting Him through tests. They're testing the Lord. And now He has actually dealt with them in a sense of provision. The wells? Okay, yeah, okay, He provided that. Water that needed to be made sweet? Okay, we get that. So we have like three tests that are related. Water that's bitter, throw the wood in it. Wells, there they are, in an oasis. That's the most natural way they would expect it. And then, the most unnatural, supernatural way, on a hill shooting out of a rock, in the middle of a desert. Okay? So this is like absolutely intellectually defying. Yes, Rick. They lived on an island between the Nile branching off and around them in the city of Avaris. They did not know water shortage. They did not know that. We need water, and we have to rely on this like daily. In Egypt, even a drought, meaning you can't, a famine is not prompted by the Nile drying up. That never happened. It was prompted by the rains and the flow of the Nile not coinciding properly with the planting and the harvesting. Right. And it would nullify their harvest. And many times, because they got too much rain. Or the Nile overflowed its banks and didn't just irrigate the fields, it swamped them for too long, and they couldn't get a harvest. So you can go back in history, and this gets really wonky and down in the weeds, excuse the pun. But there are times of famine in Egypt that occurred not because the Nile dried up. That's what we think, famine, okay, no rain. Now, if it didn't rain in the Negev, which is the southern area of the hot plains of Israel, they relied on rainfall until Isaac irrigates out of the wells. The Philistines do not do that. If they don't get rainfall, they head to Egypt. But in Egypt, they get famine when it doesn't coincide properly with the planting cycles, and they have crop failure, which happens for 7 years. But it's preceded by 7 straight years of perfect timing on the water supply. Perfect timing. And the Pharaoh thought himself pretty, hey, look at me. I have controlled the Nile 7 years in a row. Look at this. What do you do when you're Pharaoh and you have 7 bad years in a row? Uh-oh. Hey, Pharaoh, what are you doing? Huh? You go see Joseph. But remember, Joseph warned him, this is the way it's going to go. And Pharaoh, you have no say in this. This is the way it's going to be. But you can prosper in the middle of this. And he went for it. So, that's a little review, a little tag back there into the earlier book in Genesis. So now they've had water 3 times. And now, why did God not lead them up out of Egypt the way of the sea, the highway of the kings up by the sea? Why did he not lead them that way? Quickest way. War with the Philistines. But he does introduce them to war. And who's it with? The Amalekites. So now they're going to meet an enemy that's a thorn in their side from here on out. So the Amalekites come. So it's important that they learn that God's the provider, and they hear what did Moses say in the song? The horse and the rider are thrown into the sea. He's triumph gloriously. He fights for us. He's a warrior God. And he is our banner. He will fight for us. So the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. You kind of wonder if it's because they're grumbling about the water. I'm just saying. You start grumbling about things, the Amalekites may be drawn by grumbling. And Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." How many of you know you want that staff of God with you? So far, it's been stretched out over the water. It's been stretched over the land of Egypt before that. Over the Nile. It has been stretched out over the sea. You come through. It struck the rock at Horeb. We like this staff of God thing. So he says, "Tomorrow I'll stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. Tough detail. You all fight, we're going up to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. So I don't know if Moses does, okay, let's do this. Let's see this. How about if we do this? What happens if we do this? You know, no, don't mess with us, Moses. Don't be doing that. So whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, how many of you know it's hard to hold your hands up? Just a little physiology for you today. Why is it hard to hold your hands up over your head like this? What's that? Has to do with blood flow. Because you have these things in your veins that are like valves. And they work really good this way. Because of gravity. They're compensating for gravity. But when you lift them up like this, how many of you ever feel your shoulders get tired? Your arms get tired? Because it's not able to retain the blood up there and recirculate it correctly. And so you get deoxygenated blood, and then your muscles are going, Hey, we're going to start cramping here. This is not right. And so if you're painting or doing things like that, it's like, oh, I got to stop. Okay, let me rest here. What are you doing? You're reoxygenating your muscles, and you're recirculating your blood full of oxygen. And you do that for a while, then what? You can go back and do it again. Right. So isn't that interesting that he's told to hold up the staff. Well, what does God know about human physiology? This is something you naturally can't do. I'm going to ask you to do something, but what you do naturally is not enough. So he holds up the staff, and as he holds up his arms, Israel wins. Gets tired of holding up his arms. Like, oh man, you can only do this so long, guys. Hey, wait a minute, the battle's just shifted. The Amalekites seem to be advancing against our position. We can't have that. Okay, back up with the arms. And so he's holding them up as long as he can, and then down they come again. He gets a little break, back up. And so they're watching this correlation. There's a correlation here between when you hold up your arms with the staff of God and when you drop them. So it's not like Moses is messing with them. Hey, let's see how many can die this time. You know, easy for me to say, I'm up on top of the hill. You guys are down there fighting in the valley. So when Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. I like that. He sits on a rock. I like that. Now, we know that staff can split a rock and bring forth water. But now he sits on the rock, a rock, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady. So it's going to take more than just Moses, isn't it? There seems to be, it's going to have to be a team. It's not about Moses, okay? And so Moses, is he a weak man? Sure. No, he's not necessarily weak, but he can't stand or hold his arms up all day. How many of you have tried to, how many of you have ever gotten tired? It's okay if you admit this is not a trick question. During praise and worship, holding your arms in the air. Right? And this is a phenomenal thing. We can say this as Pentecostal. I know I've experienced it as others have. But there have been times that I have to say, when you get in the Spirit, when there seems to be a place where heaven is touching the earth, and then you realize, you know what? I raised my hands and praised the Lord for like 40 minutes. And my hands aren't different color. I haven't lost feeling. I haven't gone into some cardiac arrest. How in the world did that happen? Well, gee whiz, I wonder if in that circumstance, maybe the power of God and the presence of God might have stepped in there and touched you and enabled you to do that. You think? Think that could be so? No, that's why I precisely said this is, but have you ever in the process of just being in, just praising, and you're like, okay, I put my arms down for a while. It's not because, now people are going to think I'm not very spiritual, but man, crying out loud, my arms are hurting. And if I just hold them down for a song, okay, I can go back to it again. And so we're not going to judge you by whether your arms get tired in worship, or whether you sit down or stand up and worship, okay? And you say, well, I'm tired. Well, if you were in the Spirit, you wouldn't get tired. Pastor said, if you were in the Spirit, you wouldn't get tired. This is not about, but I'm telling you what, when we were in meetings that happened, we wanted every meeting to be that way. And as somebody started bailing out, we're going, what's the matter? You're not with God? You know, as kids, I'm talking about kids. Oh, well, you're just not very spiritual. Getting tired during worship. Shame on you. You know, so here's this instance where he's up on the hill and his hands remained steady till sunset. Why? Because he had help. Aaron and Hur. I love that picture. He's sitting on the rock and Aaron and Hur are saying, we're not going to let you drop your hands. Isn't that a great picture of somebody coming to your side and holding up your hands? Isn't that powerful? Somebody, and this is literally his brother and another one. This is not another brother. This is Aaron. This is Aaron, one of his brothers, his older brother, by the way, and another. And they come and serve him, and as a result, his hands remain steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. What is that telling us? That they have no power in themselves to take care of the water in the desert, or to fight the battles they're going to fight. This is the lesson. It's going to take a cooperation of you with me. Because what's in Moses' hand? It's a rod. But he can't hold his arms up long enough to get the victory. And so others pitch in and help. And so he's sitting on the rock, and they're lifting up his arms. And the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. This needs to be remembered. Now notice in these other events, he hasn't specifically said, take a scroll and write this down. This needs to be remembered. He said, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it. Joshua was down fighting the battle. Moses was up on the hill. All he knows is he sees Moses with his arms up. That's all he knows. He doesn't know all the details. Well, we set him on a rock. And Aaron, he stood at one side and Hur the other, and we held his arms up. Joshua doesn't know that. He simply knows that Moses stood on the hill with his arms up with the rod of God in his hand. So, and what?
And we won.
And we won. Yes.
New Living says, write this on scroll as a permanent reminder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he wants Joshua to know the details. And then he says, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Wonder what Amalek did. So, we actually have time, and I'll be able to connect to Amalek. Is that okay? If we connect that into modern history, would that be all right? Okay. Because we're about out of verses, which will let me kibitz on this. Okay. So this is God's promise. I will blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. So there's a problem with Amalek. Now, he's already said the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. But now he singles out, and who's the first battle they have? The Amalekites or the Amalekites, and either one's fine. We don't have to. We just don't have to feel. If we actually heard it in their language, we probably would choke half to death if we actually said it. But yes, yeah, we'd have a hard time. So he said, because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord. Now you hear that? God is showing something to the Amalekites as well as to the Jews. He says, because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord. So what does Moses do? He holds his hands up, and Israel prevails over Amalek. See that correlation? What's been going on with Amalek? We're getting a little insight here. They have lifted their hands up against the throne of the Lord. So what does he do? He uses the same sign, evidently, to defeat them. He said, so that's the way you like it. Well, we're going to deal with you on your turf.
But in that same spot, Moses builds the altar and calls it Yahweh Nissi.
The Lord our banner.
The Lord my banner.
The Lord my banner. He goes before me. A banner is used to go into war, into battle. And so the Lord is my banner. And so I will complete, he said, because hands were lifted up against the throne. So here we have Moses building an altar. Does that sound familiar? What happens when Abraham builds an altar? He names it by a name of the Lord that's been revealed to him in that setting and situation. And so Moses builds an altar and calls it, it's a marker. Now, altar can mean a place of sacrifice, but it also can be a pillar of remembrance, a marker. It's a square construction of stones, uncut stones. And he calls it, the Lord is my banner. So it's a reminder that here at this spot, the Lord is my banner. He's the one that goes ahead of me. We're going to remember this. Now, this is not the first time they do this, but he's always saying, when your next generations ask, why is this marker here? These are those hysterical markers I've talked about, right? Why is this marker here? Why are, these stones are not accidental, okay? This is not just a volcanic mud flow or something. This is pieces of rock purposely in a designed fashion stacked up. So we can say, it's kind of like the old cowboy that says, you know what? If I find a tortoise on the fence post, I know he didn't get there by himself. Somebody's been here. And so when you're in the desert and you go, wait a minute, this is not a natural formation. This took some effort. Why is this here? Out here in the desert, why is this here? Oh, glad you asked that. This is where we defeated the Amalekites because Moses, see that hill? Moses sat on a rock and had Aaron and Hur hold up his arms. And what do you know? We find out later the Amalekites had lifted up their hands against God. And so God basically, prophetically, has Moses do the same thing they had done against him and gives Moses the victory over Amalek. Yeah.
The exact same thing. Like, Moses is getting a lesson. Israelites are going to
lesson. Yeah. Depending on where they're at. Okay. So, he said, the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. Something about these Amalekites, Amalekites. They have done something, and God has declared war against them. Now, he doesn't say, I will obliterate them from under the heavens, does he? He says, I will be at war with them. I will be at war with them. Which makes you wonder, what in the world did they do? They did something. Let's go. Okay, so, any questions on that before I take a couple minutes to make some interesting connections to the Amalekites? Yeah.
Is that figurative for a specific action, or they literally lift their hands up?
I think they probably used that, and it probably had to do with some form of occultic worship and an expression of...
Like
of what did they do at Babel in Genesis? At Babel. When not necessarily the Amalekites. Let's think back to the Tower of Babel, 11th chapter of Genesis. We've been there, remember?
Yeah.
We've been to the Tower of Babel. And they said, come, let us join together and build, and let's get a tower and into the heavens, let's go and take God off his throne. A portal. We're not talking about a high tower that's going to be so high it's going to go into the heavens. We're talking about, how many of you ever seen Stargate? Okay. This is more likely. The ziggurats and these things, their worship and what they did and their sacrificing was they were trying to reestablish communication with the beings that were on the earth previously and the reason the flood came.
Were they working with the Nephilim? Because they had knowledge of things.
At the Tower of Babel, yeah. They had to be dabbling in the occult. Okay? So bear that in mind. These people are dabbling with gods, goddesses, and all this other stuff. And they have declared war on God. They have shaken their fist at God and said, we're gonna come up with a way we're going to deal with this. Now, in Egypt, have they declared a war on God? No. They're trying to worship gods, regional gods, area gods. They're worshiping everything that moves, literally. These people are different. These are over in the Sinai Peninsula, over towards Arabia. And they have said they've lifted up their hand against the Lord. So they seem to be more knowledgeable about God than the Egyptians are. And they seem to somehow be connected to Babel from the dispersion from Babel. Okay? So we know that much. Go ahead.
Aren't most of us connected? I mean, that's how we got the...
But you have different people who are like Nimrod. Nimrod was began to become a Gibeorim. He was a man of significant stature and so on. There were other people that were merely there, and then they scattered out from there. And they came away in different... The Semites were nothing like the Amalekites. Abraham, and they're different in as far as their positioning towards gods, goddesses, and all this other stuff. And God singles out the Amalekites. So we at least agree, we can't go too far with our inferences, but He singles out the Amalekites, and He goes, I saw what you did, and I'm going to be at war with you for generations. So, let's take the last 10 minutes, kind of bonus material, okay? The Amalekites. We see the Amalekites several times, and we're going to jump ahead to the book of Esther. And there is a man that we run into that is ingratiated to and is a friend of the king, interestingly enough, back up in the area not far from where Babel was. Okay? The plain of Shinar. They're now in the... It's Haman, and he's an Amalekite. There's actually other skirmishes with Israel, and somebody flees for their life. And where do they go? They go north. And their lineage shows up in the book of Esther. What are they? Amalekites. And how does God feel about Amalekites? There's something about them that He is righteously angry at. And they are consistently seeking to destroy His people. Okay? You with me? Okay. So, we have Queen Esther. And it's very curious. We don't have time right now. I'm just going to give you a thumbnail sketch. In the book of Esther, she actually makes a request of the king. And as a result of the request of the king and the exposure of a plot, Mordecai is exonerated. She, a Jewish girl, is okay. And the man who was going to hatch the plot, the Amalekite, he and his sons are all hung. Now, it's very curious in the book of Esther that, first of all, in the Jewish writings of the book of Esther, actually the names of the sons of Hadad appear in a form that actually literally draws out gallows on the paper, the way they arrange the letters in the Hebrew. Very interesting. She does a curious thing. After he's granted her request, it's been exposed and they're executed. She then appeals to the king again, but she seems to not be appealing to the king that's in the room. But she appeals to the king over Israel, the king of glory, and asks for this to be carried out against the Amalekites. So you can read this on your own. Go look in the book of it. It's very curious because she repeats herself after the punishment's carried out. And so this has caught the thinking of the Hebrews for a very long time. And another interesting little feature is appearing in the book of Esther, there's different size letters. Now the general rule is all letters must be the same, unless they are above or beyond, below the line like they should be and are final, but they aren't supposed to vary in size. But there's four letters that are a different size that appear in the book that if you put them together, comprise a number. And the Hebrew scholars for centuries have been wondering what's that about. And so... back in the Middle Ages, one of the Jewish scholars warned that there would arise a people, and he said, from Germania. And they are from the Amalekites. And they will become a mighty force against our people. Strange, I know. I go, what? Prophesying in the middle of the century? What? A Jew? What? And so, they were arguing this prayer of Esther has not been fulfilled because she prayed it after it had been fulfilled. So, what is this about? And so, World War II comes. There is the move by the Nazis to extinguish the Jews. They are defeated in war, and 11 of them face trial at the Nuremberg trials and are put in jail awaiting sentencing. And the sentencing is purposely put off one day because they now must decide, is it going to be by being shot or hung? And one of them, I believe it was Goebbels or Goering, said, no, he said he was lobbying for them to be shot like a soldier, not hung like a common thief. And they finally announced after waiting one day that they would, in fact, be hung. There was a cyanide capsule hidden beneath one of his teeth. And one of them, Goering, Goebbels, one of them, committed suicide by cyanide poisoning his cell, leaving 10. And those 10 were hung on the first day of the new year of the Jewish calendar, were hung by the neck until dead, outside of the Nuremberg prison, and the numbers that are tucked away in the book of Esther coincide with the date that they were hung. That's one of those things that makes you go, why? You gotta be kidding me. I've looked at it. It's there. It's there. And so this old Middle Ages rabbi said, there will be a people come from Germania. And he points to them and says, some of these are the seed of the Amalekite. And God is going to deal with them. And so this battle that began in the Sinai Peninsula, coming right out, extends all the way from there until 1945. In September, as it switched over from one year to the other with Rosh Hashanah, which, if I'm not mistaken, just happened a week ago. Isn't that interesting? So we can kind of celebrate the anniversary of a battle of God against the Amalekites. And he said, I will be at war with that generation. Notice he says, from generation to generation, I will be at war with the Amalekites. As long as they're on the earth, I will be at war with them.
If I remember correctly, the Nuremberg trials, the chief prosecutor for the United States was actually a Jewish descendant.
No, could be. There's a whole lot of detail there. It's fascinating. Yes, Rick?
Were the Amalekites involved in the war?
Were the Amalekites involved in worshiping Molech? I don't know. I don't know. They're an interesting generation. They're an interesting group of people. And they come out to fight the Jews in the wilderness of Sinai. They haven't even gotten the law yet. And they're there to take them out. And God says, I will be at war with them from generation to generation. So I just told you the other end of the bookend. Okay? This is the beginning. And the bookend may not have been in September of 1945. It may yet be another generation of Amalekites that rise up and decide, we're going to destroy you. And what does God say? Oh no, I'm going to fight against you, because you lift up your hands against heaven. And so he's put that symbol there. Moses has got the rod of God in his hand and his hands in the air. And he's basically saying, you don't want to mess with these people. Because the Lord's fighting for them. The Lord's fighting. Yes, Rick? The first battle. The first time they fight a battle. Everything else, they've never fought in it. Yeah. Matt. They're Edomites. But those Edomites, and we're... Okay, I've got 30 seconds.
Go.
I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. There's a very interesting connection between Esau, the Edomite, and Rome.
The Etruscans.
If you translate one of his grandsons' names, Zepho, into Etruscan, and then you come over to the Romans, it becomes she-wolf. And now you have the legend of Romulus and Remus and the she-wolf. There is a deep historical connection between Esau, the brother of Jacob, which is later called Edom, and the extinguishing, attempted extinguishing of the promised seed. So we can go from there and realize this. The Edomites lived north of the Dead Sea, up in those hills to the east. Beside them lived the Nabataeans, which were camel caravanners and shipping guys that moved stuff all over the world. Herod the Great, his mother was Nabataean, and his father was Idumean, which was another name for Edomite. And Herod the Great, because of this connection between Esau, Edom, and Rome, was friends with Mark Antony. They spent time together in their youth. And then, when Mark Antony died by suicide and political intrigue, he then switched his allegiance, obviously, to Augustus. So Caesar Augustus, Octavius, became Caesar Augustus. And Herod formed an alliance. And he was appointed as king over Judea. But he was not Jewish at all. He married the daughter of the high priest, Mariam, and converted to Judaism as a proselyte. His sons were half Jewish. Herod Archelaus, Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, and the other Herod. His name slips my mind. Agrippa? That might have been later. Were they part of the Tetrarchy? And so Herod himself, Herod the Great, that pursued Jesus and killed all babies 2 years young and younger, was what? Edomite. He was half Edomite and has a deep connection into that Amalek idea. Interesting. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Amazing connections. And so it's helpful to know those things. And they may, there's those things that make you go, So let's wrap it up now, and let's just pray that as the Lord is leading us and guiding us, He is trying to show us His all in all. He is omnipotent. He is omnipresent. He is omniscient. And we're wrestling all the time. I don't know about you, but I am. With how is it that you're here? You say you're here. How is it that you're here? It doesn't seem like it. You've led me here, but there's no provision. Why did you do this to me? And what we realize that he's testing. Do you trust me? I'm about to show you something. Or I'm about to take something I've shown you, and it's now not just information. It's going to now inform you and reform you and transform you into something new. And then you're going to trust me, and you're going to walk with me, and you're going to be able to say, well, of course God is here. Of course God is here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Of course God is here in Fort Worth, Texas. Of course God is here at Vision Church. Of course God is with me at work. He doesn't ever leave me or forsake me. I know He's with me. And He's revealing Himself continuously, how He is with me, to what extent He is with me. And we never get out of the pattern of revelation, which is information, and then it's integration and application and then reformation. And it transforms and changes us. So Lord, we're excited because we see this pattern. You've put it out where we can see it in history. And that You want to reveal Yourself increasingly and exceedingly to us in the context of our life, amongst the questions and the lack and a, we don't understand this moments, the places where we really, we know we feel like grumbling. We feel like complaining. We feel like saying, what in the world? I thought I heard from God on this. What in the world is going on? He said, look, I'm following the cloud and here we stand with no water. What in the world is going on? Lord, I just ask that You'd help us to consider and to now have a revelation of what's going on here. And let it be more than tradition or history. Let it become real. And let it become powerful in our lives, transforming us to the glory and the honor of Jesus, the Christ of God. We just ask that and we thank You for that in Jesus' name. Amen.